when you first went to Head and Race Course, what was it like there? How was it organized for being a military training center?
Those hutments had been built.
Yeah, describe as much of it as you can remember.
Huts, which there was 30 men to each hut, 15 either side. Part of the original buildings, which had been used as a race course, they were put into use, you see, for storage purposes, and on the grandstand some of the office part was being used as officers' quarters up top there. They were very comfortable, no doubt. Oh, they were all right with stoves and things in the room, so nothing to worry about in the huts.
So part of the race course had actually been, part of the race course buildings had actually been used by the military?
Yes, and the race course was derelict, of course. There'd been no racing there for years.
Mm. What about the racing stables? Were they used by
the... Yes, we used them. We signals had our horses in there.
Yeah.
Just the light horses. There was 12 free standings and a loose box at each end. So that we could accommodate 14 or 15 horses there. There was one or two lean-tos outside, back of the brickwork, so we had one or two horses in there, but we'd, I think, about 15 horses altogether.
Yeah. But let's talk a bit about the battery, about its size and the units that made it up, and what the function of each unit was. Start off telling me, first of all, about the size of the battery.
We had four 4.7 guns, ex the Boer War. It was a naval gun which had been put on a land carriage for the part of the some siege, I believe. Sir Percy Scott was the man who did it, and the gun, as it was designed, had 14 inches recoil, which why it was sufficient on a ship where it was on a fixed mounting. On a carriage, it was not, and when they were used in France, we didn't have them, but some of the territorial batters took them out. This gun jumped backwards, and they had to have a post in front with a length of rope, what we call a spring, to keep it in position. Mm. But they were terrible guns to work. You know, the 60-pounder, which we got to take into France, they had a long trail behind with a spade on the end of it, and the gun recoil was 56 inches, which, of course, absorbed the shock. Maximum was 60, but normal recoil was 56 inches. You had two big chambers with springs in, which pushed it back again. And in the centre, there was the recoil chamber, which had oil in it, a long cylinder. And the piston had a notch in one side, and there was a gradually increasing ridge inside the cylinder, so that the aperture through which the oil passed from one side to the other became less and less, and the resistance increased, you see. But of course, that was merely to check the recoil, like a modern shock absorber on a car. The springs had to push it back again.
I see.
But of course, as this gun barrel weighed 4,200 weights, you've got to have some fairly powerful springs and do it in on long slides, which are kept great, of course.
And there were four of these in the battery?
Four 4.7 in the battery.
Yeah. Tell me about each gun and its crew. You know, what the members were and what jobs they did.
There was a sergeant in charge. He was regarded as number one. He was generally called number one, you see. There was the limber gunner, who opened and closed the breech when you were in action, and in normal times he serviced the gun, was in charge of cleaning it and all that sort of thing. Then there was the gun layer, who of course he aimed the gun every time, and then the rest were ammunition numbers.
How many ammunition numbers would there be?
There's supposed to be a total of 8 in the crew, but of course that was in theory, because very often we didn't have sufficient people on hand.
So there'd be about 4 of these ammunition men?
Yes, there should be. Mm.
I see. Mm. And apart from the gun crews, there were a lot of horses in the battery, weren't there?
No mechanical, all horses.
Yeah. How were the horses allocated per gun? And
8 horses to each gun team. Mm-hmm. 4 horses to each wagon team. The water cart had 2 horses. Then, of course, you had to have so many spares. Then there was the ammunition column. They had about 60 horses for all the limbers and wagons, you see. Each gun had 3 limbers. The firing limber, and then the first and second line.
What's a limber?
Well, that's an articulated vehicle the rear port just has a pole to attach it to a hook on the front part, you see. And each one carried so many rounds of ammunition, you see, to interaction. But we never used them in action, very rarely. Mm. But we used to carry in France what they called the Echelon of ammunition. Hey.
Now, when the gun was going to get underway, how would the gun crew organise things to actually move the gun? What would be the features of the operation?
Well, you just harness the horses in, you see, and then when all was ready, you get the order to walk, march. The word walk, the each driver would put his whip on the off horse's neck, you see, just that's a sort of a signal to it. And then when he got the word to march, I'd just, you know, give it a nip and that, and they're all pulled together, you see. If you get eight horses all pulling as one, they can move it. And that was one thing we had to do. Apart from training the men, you had to train the horses. The first time we yoked up in those 4.7, which only weighed 5.5 tons, you had 8 heavy drafts in it. But the guns had been stood some time, and they were maybe, you know, a couple of inches or more into the ground. They broke the traces twice. And it was a long time before I could get the horses all to pull as one.
Mm-hmm. I see.
If I had any difficulty, we had drag ropes, which you would hitch onto the linchpins, on the, like sort of drag washer, on the side of the, on each wheel, you know, on the gun, not on the limber. And you could, these drag ropes would take the strain. If you're putting, say, 60 men on one side, you've got a gun in a hole, you'd double bank the first one, double rope, otherwise you could break it, because 60 men, or whatever you had, say 30, you'd get the order, sort of a, together, and you went up like that, you said, together, heave. And all the men would heave just as one. And it used to be an accepted thing that under those conditions, 5 men were equal to a horse, because they could put such a concerted pull into it, you see. And very often when you got a gun stuck in a hole with horses, you couldn't get them all to pull absolutely dead in as one, you see. Maybe 2 or 3, one after another, but you could get all the men at the signal from the NCO, the sergeant, would be like that, walk, march. Well, of course, as he dropped his hand, the horses were all spurred and the men all pulled, and out that gun would come.
Good.
No bother.
Good. Okay, that deals with the gun and the gun crew. Let's talk about some of the other parts that made up the battery. Now, you told me there were ammunition wagons.
Ammunition.
How many were there, and what type were they?
These limbers. Hmm. There were 3 limbers to each gun. That was 12 limbers for the 4 guns. Then in addition...
A limber would be a horse-drawn carriage, but
Yes. You had 4 horses for that. And then the rest of the ammunition was carrying the GS wagons, general service wagons. Tear 1,500 weights, 2 or 3 quarters a rule, to carry 1,300 weights on the side of the wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And you had 4 heavy horses to pull a total weight of 2.25 tons. And I've seen them stuck many a time with that. Well, in the town, one horse could pull it easily without any bother.
Good. Now, there were other people within the battery who were specialists at various jobs, like the farriers, for example.
Yes.
What sort of numbers did they make up, and what were their equipment?
With 3 farriers, and they had an anvil apiece, of course, with boxes and boxes of horseshoes, plus the portable forges, and the various hammers and tools for shoeing the horses, you see, for paring the hooves, knives, and all that sort of thing, because... The horse wanted shoeing normally once a month. They wear the shoes out in 4 weeks on the road, not on the grass, but on the road. They wear the shoes out in about 4 weeks, so you put fresh shoes on. You prise the old shoe off, you see, and then you pair it level. You have the new shoe is heated in the forge, and then he has the foot between his legs. Like he just presses the new shoe onto the hoof, so as to make its own bed. It just smokes and stinks for a few seconds. The horse doesn't feel it, you see. Well, then when that's done, it's plunged in water, and then it's put in position again, and the nails are driven through so that they come out at the side of the hoof, and then they're all turned over and cut off, so that the nail is... They're very soft nails with a wedge-shaped, square-topped head, and the shoe has holes fitted to fit those like that, you see. It's like a sort of a sunken rivet, like a countersink it is.
Did the farriers have any other jobs apart from shoeing horses?
No, No.
What about the sort of general care of the horses if they were ill? And did you have?
Oh, we had an outside vet used to come in for that in England.
I see.
And but otherwise, the captain or the drivers themselves, if the horse was not fit for service, it went out. You see, you didn't mess about doctoring horses. You simply got a remount. You see, from the remount depot.
Yeah. Now you had saddlers as well. What was their job?
Mostly repairing nose bags, because the wear on nose bags was terrific. You see, a horse, when he's feeding with a nose bag, if the strap is over his head, it's too long, he can't reach it, so he puts it on the ground, and he rubs it like that, get every bit out, and he's rubbing the bottom of the nose bag on the ground all the time. Wear him out in no time.
Mm. And is that all the saddlers did?
They had to repair harness as well, you see, but the wear and tear on harness was nothing near as much as the repair on the nose bags.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the wheelwrights.
Yeah.
Billy Newlove was the chief man there, I remember his name. Little squat fellow with a sort of beaky nose and very fair hair.
And what was their responsibility?
All the wooden part of the vehicles. The wheels we had on those guns to start with were wooden wheels with an iron tyre on, you see, and the first 60 pounders we got, they had a wooden wheel, and then a second wooden wheel was bolted right through the fellow, and it was about an inch less diameter, so that normally you ran on a 6-inch wheel on hard ground. As soon as you got on soft ground and it began to bed in, the width of the wheel was doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very good wheels. Much better than the later ones. We got the steel tractor wheels with diagonal bars on. Well, they ran very badly. The drivers used to say that they took twice as much pulling as the wooden wheel with a continuous round tyre, see, smooth tyre.
Yeah. Now, there were water carriers as well. What was their job, and what equipment did they use?
They just had a cart. It was a cylindrical tank, 110 gallons capacity, mounted on the wheels, that's all. And the pipe came out from underneath, spread into a bar, and there were four taps on that, so that they could fill the dixies, you see.
Mm.
You wanted rid of your water as fast as you could when you got up the battery. You didn't want to waste time, so they could fill four dixies at once. And then we used to store the water, the dixies with the cover on, you see. The cooking dixies, they were oval things, you know, about, I say, 2 or 3 gallons capacity. Like that. And then, in addition, we used to use cartridge boxes. They were metal lined, of course. We used to fill those. They held about 10 gallons of water.
Were the water carriers carrying water for the horses as well as for the men?
No. We didn't have any horses up at the battery.
Uh-huh, I see.
They were all behind.
Yes.
They delivered the ammunition, whatever it was, by night when it came up. They go straight back in, you see.
Mm.
The wagon lines were always near a plentiful supply of water. Mostly, in my experience, we were generally in or near somewhere near the River Somme.
Now, apart from the water carriers, there were signallers, and you were one of those.
That's right.
What was the size of the signal unit with the battery, and what sort of?
At first, there was in the first battery, there was about 15 of us starting. We got a few more later on. We went down to Paul in early 1915. It was Easter week, the week before Easter. And we had a sergeant from the Army Ordnance Corps to take us on gun laying as well. And we went to Sunk Island with 2 6-inch guns and a barn shroud rangefinder mounted on three towers, you see.
Yeah. Just tell me, how many signallers were there with the battery?
Well, with a 6-gun battery, there was 31.
31 signallers.
3 NCOs and 28 men.
Yeah. And the basic the basic task of the signallers was to provide information for the people who actually fired the guns.
That's right.
Yeah.
Communication from brigade headquarters behind up to the battery, and then from the battery forward to the observation points, which wherever it was, to the OP exchange, because as a rule, apart you had a direct line to your own battery, then you had what they called the OP exchange, which is between the batteries and the front line, you see. So that all OPs, if necessary, could get through. If their own line was this, they could get through via the OP exchange, you see.
Okay. We'll go into a bit more detail about signalling in a minute. Of course, there were some officers with the battery. Were they specialists? Did they have special jobs, or were they just for general disciplinary purposes?
No, they, as a rule, they were gunnery officers, you see. The one officer who was not with the battery was the captain. He stayed at the wagon lines, all us, I'm now talking of when we were in France, you see. He's in charge of transport. The major is in charge of the battery as a whole, you see. And he's on gunnery, you see. He relies on the captain for the transport. Well, then you had a first lieutenant who was sort of a spare man, shall we say. Then each second lieutenant had two guns, a section as that was termed. Right, centre and left sections on the six-gun battery. So you had three second lieutenants.
That would be with a six-gun battery.
Yes, with a six-gun battery.
This was a four-gun battery.
You only had two then, you see. And then the signal officer was, as a rule, as an officer who was regarded as not being good enough to go on the guns, because under active service, you've got experienced NCOs with the signalers, and the sort of understanding was that they would see things all right. And in my experience, you get a new signal officer, you know, oh, who's this bloke, etc. And the bit, he'd say, well, what's the programme today, Corporal? And you'd tell him what you're going to do. Very well, carry on. That was it. Anyway, he asked you what he had to tell you to do.
Yeah.
You never had an officer who was specialised on signals.
You didn't?
No.
No, I see. Now, the whole battery amounted to about 200 men, you're saying?
The four-gun battery, yes. Yeah. 200 men and five officers.
Yes.
A six-gun battery, 300 men and seven officers.
Was there much feeling of the battery being a team and working as a team?
Oh, yes. The sections were. You had rivalry between the sections, of course, especially on the football field.
Yeah.
I mean, this battery, we had four football teams, A, B, C and D, ammunition column and reserves, you see. And then the signalers. And strange enough, we signalers were only 15 men. There was only D sub could touch us.
Now, I want to concentrate now on your training as a signaller, and starting off with the kind of equipment you use and the way you used it. You told me yesterday that main item of equipment was telephones. So, tell me about the telephone equipment.
Well, the telephone, I've forgotten what the name it was now, but it had apart from the telephone itself, it was buzzer as well, you see, you know, Morse. And we used that more than the actual speech. You had to learn Morse, you see. The first thing we did was to learn Morse. We had a number of cards with the signs on, you see. A, dot dash, B, dash and three dots. I can do it, don't know. And we had to learn that. Well, the semaphore, when you start A, B, C, D, and we had two flags and that's it. And
Hold on. So now you're telling me about flags, are you?
Yes.
Okay.
But we were in East Park every day drilling with flags. Not so much semaphore, because I suppose it was realised that they only had a comparatively short range, but we used the Morse more. And what was called flag drill, you used to have your flags at the slope, and then ready, bring it up, to position, and once through the alphabet, commence. So you started that, and if there was no wind, you've got to do a figure of eight to keep your flag unfurled, which is much harder work than if there's a breeze. And you'd get to about W, and someone would make a mistake. Well, of course, it's instantly visible to the instructor, because one flag's out of line. Stop, we've got to start afresh. Maybe do that three or four times before someone had got it, before we'd got it all perfect. And your arms literally ached, your wrists. But I realised later on that what he was doing was developing, it was not so much to learn the Morse, it was to develop these muscles. So that you kept a really good dot and dash all the time, because if you begin to flag it towards the end of a message, the dots and dashes become ragged and they're unreadable at the other end. So that's what he was doing.
Now, you also used heliographs as well.
Yes, we got those. And you have a little unsilvered spot in the centre.
In the centre of what?
Centre of the mirror.
Yeah.
It's a 5-inch mirror, ground dead flat. We were told they cost about £15 a piece then, those mirrors. They're perfectly true, they have to be, because that beam, I think at about 6 miles, the beam was only less than 50 yards wide then. So anyone outside that couldn't see it. You have two control wheels, one to control the, at the back, to control the height of the mirror, like that. The other one to traverse it round and round. And in, on an extension arm in front, you've got a little rod sticking up with a circle on that, and in the centre of that there's a little scale, white, with black marking on it, like a thermometer thing it is, with Mars. And you've got to keep the shadow caused by that unsilvered spot. As you're working it up and down, you see, that spot's moving up and down on there. And when you press it down, the spot moves up, of course, and it has to come to rest on that centre cross all the time to keep in line with the signal, the station you're sending to. So, as the sun's moving, you're constantly gradually moving those a fraction, you know, every half minute or so to keep them in line. If you've got the sun behind you, you then use a second mirror to throw the light, the beam onto your signalling mirror, you see. And you can signal in India up to 90 miles with those, because you've got a very clear atmosphere, no dust or no smoke. But you can't get anything like that in our part. But we've signalled, you know, without any difficulty, up to 10 miles or more with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you'd use the heliographs if the during the day, but what would you use at night?
A lamp. Lamp.
What kind of lamp was that?
Well, the ones we had in England was the Begbie lamp, a paraffin lamp, big square thing with a bullseye on a short tube in front, and between the bullseye and the lantern itself there were two shutters on pivots which had a little toothed wheel on the end which engaged with a rack. That rack protruded from the top of the lamp and it had a wooden knob with a big spring underneath it. When you pressed it down, it revolved the two flaps a quarter of a circle, exposing the light through the bullseye. But the noise was such that you could read these lamps up to about half a mile without actually seeing them.
And this actually happened to you once, and you got into a bit of trouble.
Yes.
So tell me that story.
Well, we used to, on training, we used to go from the hutments where the lamp was. The corporal had the lamp there. We used to go anywhere, you know, about several hundred yards away. And my friend and I, who we work in pairs, we went into this copse. Well, it was a bitterly cold night, cold wind blowing. The lamp people were all right, they were in the shelter of the hutments. Well, we were out in the open, so I soon realised that I could read the lamp without looking at it by the umpty-umpty-umpty, you see, the clattering thing. And so we got into the bushes, and we had a little flash lamp, you see, and he was writing it down while I was reading it. And when it came to the following morning, there were checks. We were the only ones who had it all correct. We'd not been looking at the lamp at all.
Did you get found out?
So we did for a week, because the officer thought he'd have a tour around wherever, you know, see where everybody was. So, because some people hadn't got anything at all, and they hadn't intended to. So when he came to where we were, he spotted us with a flashlight in the bushes, you see. So we were sort of hauled over the coals, but again, we were the only ones who got it correct.
Good. Which, you've told me about these various kinds of signalling equipment which you used. Mm-hmm. Did you actually use it all when you went to France?
Not those lamps, no. We didn't use a semaphore either.
You didn't use the semaphore, didn't use the lamps?
No, we used the flags.
What about the heliographs?
We used the My only time we used the helio was on the retreat in March 1918. And we'd lost so much wire, you know, by having to abandon it as you retreated. You couldn't really wire him. We were reduced to visual communication. And so I was signalling back towards the guns, you see, with the helio.
I see. Mm. Now, I want to talk to you now about riding school, which you told me the signallers had to go through for a couple of hours each day. First of all, what sort of horses did you have and where did they come from?
Well, most of our horses came from the States. They were unbroken. We had some English horses amongst them, but those units which were formed in August 1914, they'd sort of scoured the countryside and got all available horses. We were only formed, say, a few weeks later, and there were practically no horses left, so we didn't get any horses until about February 1915, when we were on the racecourse. And they came one night in a snowstorm. On Friday night, there was a halt on the racecourse, you see, a little platform for disembarking horses when it had been used as a racecourse. Well, we got the horse lines ready for them, and so we tied them up there, and then we fed them and watered them on the Saturday and the Sunday, and then the Monday morning they decided to start riding still. These horses had been fed and not exercised. Furthermore, the ration for a heavy horse was £14 a corn a day, and for a light horse, as ours were called, chargers, you see, or riding horses, £10 of corn a day, but nobody told us that, and they'd all got £14 of oats a day, and they were riding to go, so the riding show was rather hectic. One lad who said he could ride, after being thrown off about six times, decided he couldn't.
When riding school got underway, what were the sort of exercises you did, starting at the beginning and, you know, developing?
Well, the first point was, after that first morning, we moved our light horses into the standings in the permanent buildings, you see, the other side of the Hutments. And we were due for riding school that morning, so we were saddling up, and the Captain K came in and said we could put those blankets, saddles, etc. back where we got them from. We shouldn't see them again until we could learn to ride without them. Well, there was a horrified silence.
Go on.
Well, we got on the riding school, which is a section of the racecourse roped off about 60 or 70 yards in length, and the captain was in the middle, and he had a long last whip, like a circus ringmaster, and he was very expert with that. He could flick a horse just on its rump, and you had no saddle, you were liable to be unseated suddenly. But he told us if we came off, he said, which we would do, to lie still, that the horses wouldn't step on us. And when we came, when he told us to march, you see, the first just walk, we went round a few times like that, and then we got the order to trot. And well, when you've no saddle, I mean, that's a very jiggity-jiggity. And we came to the first corner, and because I didn't lean in, as you would on the bike, I never thought of that, and I came off. But the horses didn't step on me, no clever on me. Well, as we progressed each morning, we begun to get to a canter, which of course is more of a rocking motion. You're sat in the middle of it, and it is much easier, although it's faster, than a trot. Mm-hmm. You're not so liable to come off. Well, things went on like that until we got to the point when he started giving us little jumps to go over. Only a foot or 18 inches high, and then they got a bit higher. And then one morning, he told us to arms outward stretcher, upward stretcher, see, because always in the morning, the first order we got was the all except the leading five, drop your reins, and the leading five was changed continuously, you see, so that he didn't have these reins all the time. The reins were something to hold on to, at least. But we started going over these jumps with your arms outstretched above your head and such as that, and then the next thing it was you had to put your right leg over the horse's neck, and if you didn't get your backside fairly well across the horse's back, you shot straight off in the floor. Then the left leg over the tail, and so on, until we came round. The last part was to get your left leg over the horse's head, get back into position, because that was the most difficult of the lot.
So at times you were riding facing the rear end
That's
of the right. horse?
Yes, and going over these jumps. You couldn't see the jump, the horse would take it in. Very often you slid off over his tail. That went on until we were pretty well proficient over all these jumps like that, and doing these sort of thing. He taught us how to vault a horse bareback, so to mount it bareback, you see, without any stirrups or anything like that, which of course, if you're in a hurry, can be very vital. And then he came in the harness room one day, and the bombardier called us to attention. We were cleaning bits and stirrups and things, and I was swinging all the lot in a bag of Cali sand, another chap, you see, we used to swing them back and forth in sand to clean them. See, they were not rusted, not stainless steel or anything like that, just plain steel, you know, they rusted every time you used them. You'd all have to clean every time. And the sweat off the girths and such as that, it all to be cleaned off, and then saddles up, and that, it was an afternoon's job, cleaning your saddle and harness. And he stood, the bombardier called us to attention, and he stood there for a minute or two, and then he suddenly said, I suppose you men think I'm the largest bastard in the whole British army, you see? Well, we were a bit astounded at that, and then he said, he knew he'd been a bit hard on us, but his orders were to have us ready by a certain date. And we'd done a 2 years peacetime cavalry course, because he was seconded from the cavalry with his officer, from the regulars, and we'd done a 2 years peacetime cavalry course in 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any cross-country exercises?
Yes. From that point, he said, we'd take it more easily, not so much riding school. We'd go across country with the saddles on, you see, and jump, proper jumps, like real hedges and ditches and that sort of thing. But we didn't go on the road, you had to go straight across country.